ever any doubt that your priest needs to hear his own sermons. You will have known that when I walked over here for the processional, I come over, and I meant to give David a little whack on the arm, but it was rode right up his shoulder. It went straight against his head. So,
the other
cheek. You did. Good for you. And also that God does not have a very small amount of irony in himself. That I now have to stand here with such a sin on my head. Please forgive me, dear brother. I really just meant to teach you a lesson. But lo, God has brought me to shame. So I will stand here now knowing that I need to hear this sermon as much as anyone. And furthermore, don't tell my mommy with what I'm about to tell you now. You see, when I was raised, I was just on the cusp of the ending of the baby boomers and the Gen Xers. And my parents had children later in life, so they taught me a kind of ancient code of behavior. Oh boy, did I fail today. You see, because I was told that I was supposed to be a gentleman. And I don't know if any of you all used to get these speeches from your parents. My mother was the great purveyor of etiquette and the proper behavior, and she would say, gentlemen, do or do not do X, Y, or Z. You know, gentlemen always opened a door for a lady. A gentleman stood when a lady came to the room. A gentleman would always light a lady's cigarette, which I was wondering at 10 years old what that meant to me. Was I supposed to pull out a Zippo lighter for some middle-aged woman? I don't know. And it was dangerous as the women's movement came along. You could get slapped for that kind of behavior. And Mom would always tell me as I walked out the door with this list of things I was supposed to do, she would say, now be a gentleman. And if I ever messed up, she would tell me that I had shamed her, I'd shamed our family, and that she was not going to have people say bad things about me, and certainly by extension, bad things about her. So I knew I was supposed to behave well. And one day, though, I blew it. Big time. Fellow had been picking on me in school, and we got into a fight. Now, this was kind of the change of times as well. It used to be that teachers would look the other way when boys came to fisticuffs in the schoolyard. But this was a time in which they didn't like that. And the great irony was, is if you were caught fighting, you got spanked. It seemed to make no sense that I was not allowed to exercise corporal punishment on my friends, but the teachers and the principal could exercise it on me. But this was the rules. So with that in mind, I came home one day with a jolly big black eye. What happened to you today? I got into a fight. What? I got into a fight. Well, after dinner was the speech time. My father was usually there to stand there with a cocktail in his hand, and whenever it was appropriate to say, yes, your mother's absolutely right. Well, this time, he didn't. He sort of stood there and watched over his glasses, waiting for this speech about how I had shamed my mother and our family, and I was no gentleman, that I needed to prove myself again to community and everyone else. And my father says, yes, yes, well, let me go take him and dress his wounds. So I got inside the bathroom. Dad closed the door and said, you know, your mother's absolutely right, but don't ever turn your back on someone that takes a swing at you. I won't have you to be thought a coward. You have the dignity of yourself and your family to present, and if someone's going to pick a fight with you, you make very sure to end it. Well, you know, my dad then proceeded to teach me how to fight dirty. The whole idea was is that I was supposed to sucker punch someone. And when they went down, I was to make sure they didn't get back up. And when the teacher showed up, I was supposed to go, I don't know what happened. I think he had a heart attack. Don't do this. But they were both wrong. They were both wrong. My mother thought that I should not do it because it would bring shame on our family. My father wanted me to do it because he thought it would bring shame on me and my family if it was misunderstood. I needed to make somebody pay for offenses. What does God say? The Old Testament sets the stage. Leviticus is one of my favorite passages. It's about how we should handle money. But for them, money for them was their crops. How did they live? You know, you've heard of living paycheck to paycheck. These people were living from harvest to harvest. If they had enough food to last the year, and God willing, they had a good harvest next year, they'd live. Leaving food behind was foolhardy. You were throwing things away that you were counting on. But God told them, and if you heard of this reading from Leviticus, it was said almost resonantly, how many times? 5 or 6 times. I am the Lord, in case you forget who's talking. And what he says is, you will not harvest your fields to its edges. I want you to imagine a whole field, and you're supposed to just do the interior of it. Leave the stuff on the edges untouched. And in the middle of the field, gleanings, do it sloppy. Leave cuttings behind and grain behind. Leave it there so that the poor and the foreigner can come and find food. He even says, when it comes to grapes, don't strip your vineyard. And if you drop some grapes on the way in from the harvest, leave them there. Don't pick them up. The idea is to leave things behind. The economy for God in the Old Testament is that we're supposed to act as if whatever we have comes from Him, and that we trust Him to never put limits on it. We're never going to come up short. So we leave behind for those who have less, so it can be a gift for them as well. If you imagine this with our own money, you can see the sort of solution this is. The idea that God puts on our economy is one of abundance, of reliance not on ourselves but on Him, and a generosity that most people would think was insane. Now look at the New Testament. The first thing we hear is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This was the standard. I want you to imagine that an eye for an eye was actually a big moral surge for its time. I know you've heard the joke, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth leaves everyone blind and toothless. But imagine in a world in which honor killings, in which revenge and blood feuds and debts like that were so prevalent that you could have an escalation of revenge and reciprocity to the point that there was blood flowing in the streets almost constantly. Feuds occurred all the time. Eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was a proportional response of an equal price being extracted for the equal offense. And by the time Jesus had come along, it had kind of waned, and people were looking for something better. What Jesus says is very interesting. Now, like I hit David earlier today, in the Middle East, it's a big deal to hit someone with your left hand. I will not tell you specifically why, but the left hand is used for an unpleasant thing in the Middle East, and to hit someone with the left hand was a great offense. In the book of Luke, in the Gospel of Luke, Luke, who's talking to Gentiles, doesn't bring out the fact that it's the right cheek that was struck. But in Matthew, that we just heard read, it draws out that point because for the Jew in the Middle East, it would have been a very poignant point to make. What he's saying is, if someone strikes you on your right cheek, they're adding insult to injury. Something more than just paying you back for what you did, the blow that was an attempt to extract some sort of justice, they had added insult to injury. This was something more than just somebody having a fight like I might have had in a schoolyard. This is about somebody taking it to the next level, something more than you deserved. In the same spirit, though, that we heard in Leviticus, Jesus takes an economic consideration and makes it an interpersonal one. Jesus tells us that what we ought to do is that when someone adds insult to injury to us, that we should take it and indeed offer them the other cheek. This isn't about bullying. It's not about someone who's hit you for no reason, an injustice. What this is about is facing a conflict and using the same grace that God has given you, the same gift of abundant grace that you might have had in the harvest, you now have in your life. And you return that to someone else. When they come to you with vengeance, you don't return the vengeance. This may seem eminently impractical. It may seem as if this is some sort of offense against common sense. But I would say to you first, it's effective. It's the same behavior that we saw done by Gandhi, by Martin Luther King Jr. People that were not satisfied simply to win, but to help the people who were offending and hurting them to see their own fault. This behavior changes people's hearts and minds.
It doesn't just coerce them, it converts them. But even then, like my mother, why we do this is because that's the way Christ has taught us. It is how he has treated us by the grace that we have. And by extending that grace, what we do is we are being good Christians, good Christ-like people. So I want you to imagine we go out into a world that might have acts of vengeance against us. What we imagine is Jesus at the door saying, now go out there and be a good Christian. Don't bring shame to my name by acting by a different set of rules than the ones I've given you. And if you're worried about somebody getting away with something, think of the great principle in heaven. The person whose job it is to judge who's in the wrong and to exact punishment and to make justice is God, not us in the playground. So God calls us to be good Christians and to live by his code and to do him no shame. And by the way, to make the world a better place.